Wahine Varra's new book, Searches, is a deeply personal and provocative exploration of how tech companies have both fulfilled and exploited our human desire for understanding and connection, and how we are complicit in all of this. She's been a reporter and editor for The Atlantic, The New Yorker, and The New York Times, and is a Pulitzer Prize finalist. She's also the author of the story collection, This Is Salvaged. The name of the new book is Searches, Selfhood in the Digital Age, and it's a great pleasure to welcome back Wahine Varra to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us. A delight to have you back on the program.
Thanks, sir, for having me, Joe.
What brought you to want to explore this digital age, this really huge thing that's happening in the moment that you seem like you want to just grab by the collar and say, hold on, let me figure it out?
Yeah. You know, I think when we talk about technology, we often talk about it in kind of binary terms. Oftentimes we, the users of these technologies, say, these big technology companies are exploiting us and giving us very little in return. The big technology companies say in response, listen, we're not putting a gun to your head. If you didn't want to use these technologies, you wouldn't have to. Clearly, we are giving you something you want. I was interested in kind of taking both of those arguments at face value and accepting, acknowledging that there's truth in both of them, and that, in fact, the usefulness and the exploitation go hand in hand. And I was interested in saying that journalistically and memoiristically over the course of the book. I was also interested in figuring out how I could use the technologies themselves and the language that I use as a user of these technologies to kind of enact that on the page, to show on the page what it looks like for that to be happening.
So this started for you, if I'm understanding this correctly, with an obituary.
This started for me with one of the chapters in the book, which I think you're alluding to, is called Ghosts. It's not an obituary. My sister died of cancer in 2001. Many years later, about 20 years later, I got access to a predecessor to the technology that would become ChatGPT, this language model called GPT-3. And I used it to try to write an essay about the death of my sister and my grief over it. With that technology, as with Google, Amazon, the other technologies I'm exploring in the book, what I'm interested in here with this essay is the kind of promise that a company like OpenAI is making and saying, listen, we're going to offer you a technology that's going to produce words for you. The gap between that and what these companies are actually able to provide and what they're getting from us in providing their service, their product.
What was it that you put in to get what you got out, which eventually went viral?
Yes. Sat down with this product, GPT-3, this technology called GPT-3, and I typed the sentence, when I was in my freshman year of high school and my sister was in her junior year, she was diagnosed with Ewing sarcoma. Ewing sarcoma is the name of the cancer she had. And I hit this button for it to kind of, this AI model to continue writing on my behalf. And it generated all this text kind of in the form of a little essay about, you know, my supposed sister and how she was sick. And it invented the fact that we were lacrosse players in high school. And then at the end of this little essay, it says, she's doing great now. So what it produced was kind of the opposite of the experience that I actually had and was trying to articulate. So what I did was I deleted all of that, everything that it wrote, and I added more text of my own. And then I pressed the button again. And this time it was in some ways a bit closer to articulating something like what grief is like, but again, very far from the mark. So I deleted it again, added even more text of my own, and I kind of went through this exercise over and over 9 times. What I ultimately found was that this technology was able to generate text, generate language that sort of had the shape of what writing about grief might credibly sound like, but it never was able to articulate anything about my own experience, because I, of course, was the only one who was able to articulate something about my experience. And so the essay ends up being about my sister and her death it also ends up being about the promise a technology like this is making, or rather the promise the technology companies behind technologies like this are making, and the way in which that promise cannot be fulfilled.
So let me just step back, because I think this can be instructive. But when you would erase and rewrite and erase and rewrite, there's a form of leading the witness, right?
Yeah, what the technology, especially at that time, was decently good at sort of adopting the style of the writing it had been fed. And so my thinking was the style and the subject. So my thinking was, if I write more and then hit the button, this technology will have more of the material it needs in order to spit something back to me that kind of sounds like what I've already written. That was my thinking. And I did it in good faith. Like it's not as if going into it, I thought, it's never going to be able to do the trick. Like, you know, this is just an experiment to show that it's not going to do the trick. I thought maybe if I give it more, it's going to be able to give me more. And there's an extent, a superficial extent to which it does do that, but ultimately does not succeed.
So at the end of that exercise, what do you feel you learned that you wanted to know more about? And ultimately, when you shared the essay, of what the general public was learning about this emerging technology?
Well, I'm being a technology reporter, I always try to sort of stay abreast of what's happening in the tech industry. So as I was working on that essay, there was research being published, these kinds of technologies that increasingly showed that the technologies use up a lot of water and energy. They depend on low-paid, often exploited workers in places like Kenya and the Philippines. In order to generate language, they have to be fed billions of words of text so that they can, quote-unquote, learn the patterns among these words and therefore be able to credibly generate text. That text that they're using is used without the consent of the people who wrote it in the first place, without compensation for those people, and without credit to those people.
Mm-hmm.
That text also tends to contain biases, racial, gender, and other biases, that then, because of the way the technology is built, get amplified in these technologies' output. All of which is to say, it is not at all the case that the text these technologies generate is sort of is neutral, right? It's not just we have to understand the broader context in which this language is being generated. So my essay was published just as all of this research was also being published about the harms of these kinds of technologies, and that was something that I had to contend with. I had published the essay as a way to enact the shortcomings of the technology in terms of like what it promises and what it delivers. But there was a lot of additional baggage around the publication of the essay too. And I had to contend with this question of like whether I was critiquing the technology in publishing this essay, or whether my essay could be used as evidence by the big technology companies that like everybody should use AI to collaborate on writing essays because this author, Wahine Vara, did so and her essay went viral, right?
So what did you end with?
How did I end up feeling?
Yeah.
Well, I think that's the subject of the whole book. The subject of the book is that ambivalence, because that feeling that I experienced, I think, is not dissimilar from the feeling that we have every time we do Google searches and therefore get some information back, but at the same time are providing Google with information that it can use to exploit us and others. Similar with Amazon, similar with every other product. My question with all of these pieces in the book is, can you use form as a writer? Can you enact all these things on the page? Can I show the simultaneous self-expression and exploitation that's taking place with Google, with OpenAI, with Amazon, with all of these products, without also being bound up in, without having the material itself, this book itself, be bound up in that exploitation and the book be turned into kind of a marketing tool or even a propaganda tool, right? To say, hey, look, this writer is using our products to make a book. This must be a celebration of the products, right? the book kind of ends on that question. The book ends in a place of uncertainty, I think, because we have to acknowledge that no matter what, both like in the sort of in the instantiation of the book itself, but also in our lives, in our technological lives, when we're using these products, the usefulness of the products to us on our own terms is bound up in exploitation no matter what, right?
Well, Haney Vara is our guest. The name of the new book, Searches, Selfhood in the Digital Age. The book is published by Pantheon. Well, it brings me to a point that I was going to follow up on and what we were just talking about. And that is, so often when I use this technology, I have a wariness. And it seems that you also have a wariness at times. But that's good, right? Shouldn't we be somewhat wary?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think I'm trying to draw people's attention to our role in our use of these products, right? So if we say these companies are just exploiting us, we have no choice in the matter, in some ways it sort of frees us up to say, all right, so we can kind of just keep using these products without really thinking critically about our use of them. I think wariness is a great stance to have in using these products because it means we're engaging with them critically, right? We're asking ourselves, well, what are we giving up in order to get whatever it is that we're getting? What are the tools of coercion that may be being used by these companies in order to get us to use them, right? Like, what other choices do we have? What other choices might we make individually and collectively? So I think wariness is a great starting point for all of that.
I mean, if you look at the last 4 or 5 years while you were working on this project, even with what you have at one point does not mean you're going to have it at the next point, meaning there's always a technological advance, right? And mm-hmm. and it's coming to terms with that of is it improved? Is it not improved? Are you gaining something and losing something else? And I assume that will be the way for a pretty long time.
Yeah, I mean, I think I tend to be less interested in the technology itself on its own terms than in the fact that the technologies I'm writing about in the book are really expensive to build and therefore tend to be funded and built by people and institutions that are already wealthy and powerful. And therefore, the technologies are built specifically to, you know, continue to accumulate wealth and power for the wealthy and powerful, right? And so when we say, like, the question of whether a technology is improving or not almost suggests that, like, the improvement of the technology in some abstract sense is the goal. But I think, like, the thing that I find interesting is to think about why a technology is developing in a particular way. Like, what are the financial goals of the entity that is developing the technology that are leading the technology in that direction? And what can we learn through that about what the exploitation looks like, what the shape of that exploitation is?
So with that exploitation, it's you would want to say, well, what's the end game? But we don't know, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, if it's the case that we are being exploited without any agency in the matter, it would then follow that the end game is that the exploitation must and will continue, right, forever, infinitely. If it's the case that we have agency, that we have choice in the matter, then there are infinite possible futures, right? We can sort of choose the future we want and we can write that future. And so I would argue, I mean, the argument of the book is that the latter is the case, not the former. The argument of the book is that there are all kinds of potential futures. I don't think of it as my job any more than it's Sam Altman's job or Mark Zuckerberg's job to lay out what that future should look like. It would seem to me, it seems as if it could be hypocritical of me to say, and here's what the future should look like. Here's the one future that I think should be ahead, in the same way that I'm arguing that it's not proper for somebody like Mark Zuckerberg or Sam Altman to be making that argument, right? Like who are any one of us to be sort of solely responsible for making that determination? So my goal is to point out that we have that agency and raise the question about what we might do with it.
Let me go to cynical then. And if you want that agency, is that agency possible for you and also to make the company that's producing the product money?
Well, so toward the end of the book, I do talk about a couple of models. I'm not as interested, I think, in individual agency as I am in collective agency, right? I talk about the way in which many of the technologies that we already use are not bound up in capitalistic business models. So, for example, Wikipedia is one of the most visited websites in the world. That's run by a foundation and the text, the updates on Wikipedia are entered into Wikipedia by volunteer users, right? There are potential public-owned models, like government, local or regional government-owned models, other collectively-owned models. There are worker-owned companies. Norton, which published my first two books, is one of the largest publishers in this country, and it is worker-owned, right? And so we think about like the models that are dominant, the capitalistic models and other models that privilege financial gain over other priorities feel sometimes to us like the only way because they're so dominant, but there are all kinds of other models available to us that are actually in use, but I think we kind of forget about them. And I'm certain that there are models that have not occurred to me that I didn't write about in the book that have occurred to others and will occur to others. And so I'm interested in kind of opening up that imaginative space so that we can think about what those might be.
Is it all happening as quickly as it seems?
That's a very philosophical question. I would say, though, that sometimes I think we have the tendency when there's a new technology like AI, for example, to say, this has come out of nowhere and it's going to change everything and it has nothing to do with anything that's happened in the past. I would say that it's easy to see a kind of direct line from the mid-90s when my book starts, when the reason the internet internet access started to proliferate is that AOL started sending, they launched this multi-$100 million campaign where maybe you remember they sent CDs and floppy disks to people's homes.
Right.
And they said, put this in your computer and you can get, you know, X number of free hours of internet. And after that, you'll have to pay every month. And that's how a lot of people got online. That's how the internet began to proliferate. And so even though we sometimes look back on those days and say like, oh, it's such a sweeter time. It wasn't as commercial as it is now. Almost from the very beginning, the internet, our use of the internet was driven by the goals of companies. We just didn't call them big tech at the time. And it was the power was and wealth was less concentrated at that time. But we can draw a direct line back to that. We can draw a direct line even further back, right? This is just what we call big tech is really just the latest version of capitalism, right? It's capitalism supercharged with technology as a tool.
I don't mean to hijack the entire interview with asking this question or to go off in a completely different direction. But when it comes to the future and as things change and for our usage and for the general usage, where does regulation come in?
I mean, I think that this is a really interesting moment to be asking that question because during the Biden administration, there were some unprecedented efforts started to take a closer look at the power of big technology companies and organizations. And there was an open question about the extent to which that would continue under the Trump administration, but it is continuing. And so we're at a moment in the U.S. where it's very possible that some of the power of these big technology companies will become less concentrated. And interestingly, that began largely with sort of community campaigns. The effort, for example, to address Amazon's dominance started in part because a group of authors started pointing out that Amazon's dominance was changing the book publishing industry, was transforming their ability to make a living as authors. They were arguing that Amazon was making literary culture less diverse. They were making all these arguments, one of the people involved in helping them make this make those arguments was a woman named Lena Khan, whose name is familiar because she later became the chair of the FTC and played a central role in starting many of those lawsuits, those government lawsuits, the FTC lawsuits against companies, while the DOJ also initiated some of them. And so, you know, it's actually happening. It's happening here. It's happening in Europe. It's happening elsewhere. It's not for me to say where we go from there, but it's certainly like this conversation has been started. It's not just some abstract conversation.
Did you have to give yourself a natural endpoint to say, okay, this is where, all right, now's the time to end the story?
Well, I kind of end today, you know,
Right. Yeah.
You know, in terms of historically speaking, the moment where I end is sort of with those lawsuits, actually, with the FTC and DOJ lawsuits here in the U.S. And then from there, I look forward and imagine some possible futures that we could move into. So honestly, in terms of thinking about where to end, my book was due. It had to come out the following year. And so I thought, okay, I'll end now. But I tried to get it as up to date as I could.
Deadline is a good motivator, isn't it? Yes.
Exactly.
The name of the new book is Searches, Selfhood in the Digital Age. It is by Wahine Vara, and it is published by Pantheon. Thank you so much for being with us. What a great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you so much for having me, Joe.
Be well. Thank you. Again, the name of the book is Searches, Selfhood in the Digital Age. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.